a bit more specific examples of crop performance relative to salinity and some ideas about particular cropping systems that I'd like to discuss and share with you. I have co-authors Steve Grattan and Dennis Corwin involved in this. Actually, there's ideas from lots of people, Jim Oster, Jim Mayers, and others. The thing we haven't really mentioned is that the San Joaquin Valley is, in fact, by any standard, one of the most productive agricultural ecosystems in the world. It's long growing seasons, high quality soils for the most part, there is salinity, a huge diversity of crops. If you eat almonds, they come from here to a large degree. There's a number of things that could be said for. The question is farming there, particularly in the west side, sustainable? And this is not a quote from the same fellow that Jim admires, but in fact, you can't irrigate in semi-arid to arid regions without some effects on salinity. It's just not possible. This is a photograph that Jim Oster took, and he'll probably show it to you again, but it shows you neatly the western San Joaquin Valley meeting up with the eastern along pretty much the San Joaquin River drainage. And just below, on the low end, you can see the subsurface stratigraphy that Jan Hopman's had, but in particular, you see that the water table essentially rises towards the surface from lateral flow as you get closer to the bottom towards Mendota and other areas in the valley. Now, large areas of the valley, of the western San Joaquin Valley, are affected by salinity, particularly down in Kings County and in the Merced area, but elsewhere as well. Not all the areas, however, are as affected as others. So we have regional specific solutions that are possible. And as Jim mentioned, here's a picture of the San Joaquin Valley drain. This is the part that was built. It was eventually supposed to go all the way down to Kings County, and then, of course, particularly, it was supposed to have an outlet to the sea. But it was stopped primarily because of dilemmas eventually that developed at Kesterson. And there, finally, is a picture of Kesterson. We had malformation of ducks and other bird species that were using those temporary wetlands and storage areas. It became a huge national issue. Many of you may remember it. And it was a serious environmental toxicology problem, and it was a surprise. People really weren't expecting that, really. So these are the same issues that Jim mentioned about possible ways to manage salinity. I'm going to talk only about reuse. if we have 400 or 500,000 acres of tiles, and we want to try to evaporate the drained land, and if we want to try to evaporate that, that requires something like a 10-to-1 ratio of land for evaporation ponds. It's just way too much. It's not possible. It never was that much. And because of the contamination of these salt ponds with salinity and the fact that it's a lot of land, it's not really possible. If you reuse that drainage water to grow salt-tolerant crops, you might be able to reduce the volume of water by quite a substantial amount, not the salinity or the trace elements. Now, there's some things about the drainage water in the western San Joaquin Valley that are positive. It tends to be in a range between 4 and 12 decisiemens. They're mostly sulfate rather than chloride-type salts. These are favorable circumstances, but the occurrence of trace elements like selenium, molybdenum, boron, and others, they vary in type and amount by location, and these substantially complicate the reuse. There's some advantages from it. You reduce the drainage volume. Certainly, and that means that the water that's left that has to be managed is reduced in volume and perhaps makes it easier to manage it, reduces the costs of disposal, and provides possibly positive income. In fact, it does provide positive income. The disadvantage is that wherever you put that water, you're accumulating salts and trace elements, and you may have adverse effects on the physical and chemical properties of the soils there. So this is the schematic of the kind of system that Jim was talking about. You might even think of those as almond trees, where that water these soils are drained to both intercept salts that might be going towards the confined system or contaminating groundwater as protective, at least in part, and then as providing a source of water for the irrigation of salt-tolerant crops and forages. There may then be a second step for halophytes, there may not, and then you have this disposal issue that we just talked about. So I want to talk very briefly about some examples of irrigation of salt-tolerant crops from mostly plot-scale research, then shift to some examples of some field-scale work, and then the idea of using salt-tolerant perennials, and then a few words about cropping systems and linking it, I think, prudently to biofuel production. This is the standard Ayers and Westcott salt tolerance curve, in which this is set up for sugar beets, but it could be for a number of different crops that are somewhat moderately to highly salt tolerant. You have a period here where there's effectively no effect of salinity, and then as salinity increases, you expect to see a linear decline. There were a series of irrigation trials at the Westside, UC Westside Research and Extension Center, in which shallow groundwater was used to irrigate different crops. This was the first set of tomato cotton systems. This is another one that I did there with sugar beet. Now, this is a complicated design. There's 42 plots. How many do I have here? I think 42 plots altogether, 40 plots. And we irrigated. By this time, they had been salinized over time. And so by having applied different amounts of irrigation water, you can see the average EC to 9 feet here. And so we applied, grew sugar beets uniformly and applied either 0, 100%, 49%, or 62% of saline water to them. And this indicates that those plots had been salinized over time by varying amounts of irrigation water applied on a plot basis. But interestingly, we also saw that by the time we were doing our sugar beet work, that we developed quite a plume of nitrate and salinity and salt at about four to six feet. Basically below the effective root depth of cotton and tomatoes, and that's basically that salt had leached down there. Now, this is the fresh water set non-saline irrigation. This is saline irrigation. This is soil water depletion, precip, and irrigation as water sources. Very little difference in sugar beet. These are all within these plots are all within the threshold for sugar beet. They're really salt tolerant that way. But you can see a slight bit more of water depletion in the saline treatments than in the freshwater treatments. There was no effect on yield in that trial, but one of the things about saline water is it's not just salt, there's nutrients. So with sugar beet, if you apply knots of nitrogen, you get a decline in concentration in sugar, so that the sugar yields were affected, even though the dry matter, total dry matter and root yields weren't. One of the other interesting things about this trial is that we saw what we thought was adaptive uptake of water by beets. In the freshwater or non-saline irrigated plots, most of the water was absorbed in the surface. Remember, this is where we saw the salinity plume in this depth in the profile. Well, in the saline plots, we thought we saw more uptake, or soil water depletion at least, below that plume, which shows that crops can, in fact, deep-rooted ones in any case, have some capacity to adjust their response. Work that I haven't shown here before at Agronomy Society focuses on safflower. This is an oil seed. It's an excellent oil seed. We grew those safflower in those same plots following sugar beets. And here you can see over the range of consumptive water use, the soil water depletion in this cropping season, we didn't really see much of a seed response. And there wasn't much of an effect of soil EC or salinity levels on safflower yield across that same range. Now there's not a very well documented threshold for safflower in the literature. But at least here, up to 7 decisemes, it's considered moderately salt tolerant. At least in this trial, it seemed to be tolerant up to about that level. So here you can see non-saline irrigated plots and fully saline irrigated plots. This was the average EC to 9 feet. These were 3 of each of the plots. And you can see the seed yields, the water use efficiency values, and soil water depletion estimated from April through August. You don't irrigate safflower. You put water on at the beginning, and then it reuses groundwater. It's very deep-rooted. So one of the things, there's very little yield difference, but there was more water used in the saline plots, therefore with a little lower water use efficiency. In fact, they're trying to draw water against a salinity gradient. Now, how was that possible? Well, total dry matter of the crop increased with water use. But seed heads didn't. So what you had here was a crop-specific adjustment. The harvest index was adjusted as a function. So what the crop stopped doing with lower water use, it made less stems and leaves. And here you can see volumetric soil water content in the different plots, the salty and the non-salty, at depth at the beginning and the end of the season. And you can see that in the saline plots, there was a little less water drawn out at depth. And we also measured post-harvest an increase in salinity at that depth, and that somewhat seems to correlate with, in this case, the salinity there was higher than safflower's ability to do any recovery. And so what happened basically in this trial was that the freshwater or the non-saline treated crop continued to use water later into the season, and the salinized one shut down, but without in this case an effect on yield. So it was an interesting adjustment. Well, let's plot work. That was a good soil, was previously salinized. What happens on a field scale with some salinity, crop production and salinity measurements? I want to talk about some trials we did with sugar beets again. This is a photo from the Imperial Valley. We did work as well in the San Joaquin Valley. And this was a yield map from the Imperial Valley. This was the map on the left that was measured using that EM38 technique. You can see areas of high salinity and low salinity. The yield pretty well nicely followed that. It went from 49 tons in the better parts of the field to 26 tons. So salinity mapping was a great way to measure or predict potential production in this field. This was the sugar beet yield over, we did two trials there, and this is a profit or loss value. There's quite high profitability producing sugar beet in the better parts of the field, and then there were, especially at the high salinity levels, essentially areas where we lost money doing so. But the point is that the Moss-Hoffman threshold for sugar beet is considered to be about 7 decisiemens, but here we saw, in fact, some adjustments on a field scale over a long season, winter production, over time by beet that allowed actually quite high yields at levels that we didn't expect on a strict Moss-Hoffman equation basis. So I put it up there just to show it again. This was the same trial, same experiment. This was in the western San Joaquin Valley at West Lake sites. These are really poor soils and they've really been abandoned for crop production. And here you can see a yield map, 15 tons. In some places some of these yields were less than 15 tons. But over here, we had 40 tons, which were quite a bit higher than we actually expected. The way the study was done, there was just some hand harvest made that would correlate with locations in the field with different salinities and other physical chemical properties. Turns out that EC was not correlated at all with sugar yield in this field. This is really a scatter diagram. What it was correlated with was internal soil drainage, soil quality. The lower the saturation percentage, the higher the yield. Really, it had a lot to do with infiltration. This is a silty soil, and in fact, this physical property was what dominated the performance. And what I put this in here for is to say that we can figure out how to grow these crops on these poor soils, but it's difficult to always to predict crop response. It needs a fair amount of empirical work and trial and error. So in this case, root yield increased with lower saturation percentage. Sugar concentration actually increased the other way because the plants were getting dehydrated. They weren't getting enough water. And there were high rates of nitrate here in these soils, but they were so inaccessible to the plants because of saturated soil conditions that it didn't make any difference. One last few minutes about a few other crops, and then I'll cut off. This is farther down in the valley. This is the Tulare Lake bed. You don't see quite that line for shallow water tables. This is a site where most of this land has been abandoned for annual crop production. Jim Oster is a cooperator on this project. And it's been was leveled and drained and for research purposes and established with Bermuda grass. Now, most people don't like Bermuda grass, but its vices in your yard are virtues here. It's really tough, durable, hard to kill off, and grows pretty well under salty conditions. Here you can see the salinity map that Dennis Corwin made. The darker sites, this is ECA, and the darker sites are higher salinity levels. And you can see this actually, there are a few places where Bermuda grass won't grow or grows more poorly or where weed intrusion has occurred. And it pretty well follows that map. Bermuda grass, more or less, cannot grow above about 22 to 24 decisiemens. And so our dry matter accumulation, hay harvest equivalents, follow that rate of decline. But that site has been able to produce large amounts of Bermuda grass, which in fact in this case has been grazed. There's quite a bit of standing dry matter on any given time in the rotational grazing scheme, so we estimate around 10,000 kilograms per hectare of hay equivalent, which is a fairly substantial yield, and it's from these rather low quality soil conditions using moderately to saline water for irrigation. wastewater irrigation. So, and in the process, we've seen some reclamation. So the salinity of the surface has declined slightly. Chloride content has declined. That's an indicator of leaching. The sodium sorption ratio has declined slightly in the surface. Even boron, which is supposed to be stable, declined at least in the first foot over the first 4 years of irrigating and managing in this way. Crop growth is an important way of reclaiming soil, even difficult soil conditions. There's no change in the subsurface, which is already so saline that we can hardly make a dent in it. And this has been done with a relatively low leaching fraction. It's been a bit under-irrigated for the most part, but less than 10% of the water has been captured in tile drains. That doesn't mean that we caught all the water. We didn't, but it's a relatively low leaching fraction. So on this high sodium absorption ratio soil, high EC soil, using moderate to saline irrigation water, we haven't seen any infiltration and drainage problems, at least over the last 7 years. So it looks like this is possible to do over time. So getting close to finishing. We obviously have some crops which are halophytes, and they tolerate high levels of salinity or require salinity for best performance. For such crops, saline soils may not be limiting, and you may be able to produce them efficiently. Not all salt effects on crop growth and yield are adverse. Salinity can result in harvest index or crop quality adjustments, depending on the species. And in rotations, the responses of different crops might be organized to be complementary. Crop yield or quality responses under field conditions may also exceed expectations. Winter production is an important thing. It can help mitigate the effects of salinity on crop growth because most of the crops grow with less water stress. And lastly, there's an important necessity to really work with these systems empirically because they're not always easy to predict. Now, we talked about drainage ponds. If we reuse drainage water, the area that we need for evaporative disposal, if that were possible, if farmers were to find it economically viable, is substantially less than it would be if you're just trying to evaporate water from a straight drain. And it may help meet the midterm, but not long-term needs for salinity drainage. It requires careful and continued work on what to do about selenium, which is really the devil in the details. But the question is, how should this retired land and other salt-affected lands in the western San Joaquin Valley be managed? What I'd like to suggest is that there may be a way to link one environmental benefit to the solution of another environmental problem. We have public policies now that favor the use of biofuels. We have a global warming problem due to greenhouse gas accumulation. The crops that I've discussed, all of them would be good feedstocks, and there are others for biofuels. There's little surplus land and water in California for biofuel feedstock production other than these kinds of lands and these kinds of waters. So using salt-affected land and saline drainage and other wastewaters for biofuel feedstock may provide the strategy for managing these lands. It may help protect groundwater because we could then drain some additional lands to generate those waters and at least slow the rate of salt accumulation in the below ground aquifer. And it might provide funds to pay for it all. That needs cropping systems research. And I want to end with this. So this is a symposium, and I feel a little bit empowered, to use the old word, to actually express an opinion. It's important and essential for us to regulate, measure, and control pollution from agriculture. But if the net effect of all of those policies is to undermine the productive use of this incredibly valuable agricultural area, I feel it's a public policy failure. So that, I hope, will help us with some.